Van Friesen to the east to Prussia. And then we looked at the move from Prussia to Russia. Last night, we talked about the people who did not move to Russia and what happened in later years as they lost or not, as a result of losing their non-resistance, they became good Mennonite Nazis. Now tonight, we would like to take the story of the people who had moved on to Russia and tell the story of moving from Russia to here. I know we talked just briefly about that, but I would like to flesh that out this evening. When Catherine the Great invited these people to Russia, her inducements included the promise that Mennonites could operate a virtual community, a commonwealth, a virtual Mennonite commonwealth in Russia with complete religious freedom and exemption from military duty forever. But forever turned out to be not forever, and forever became only 100 years. The Russian government decided that Russia must become Russia, that the islands of foreign stock needed to become Russian. The days of special privileges for the German islands, the Mennonite islands, the Lutheran islands, and the Catholic islands needed to end. Russian must be taught in all the schools, and military exemption must be abolished. And that news came in 1870. The Mennonites had 10 years to adjust themselves to the new order, and by 1880, everybody needed to be full-fledged Russian. And so, the news shocked the Mennonites. How could forever not be forever? Without wasting time, the Mennonites sent delegates to the Tsar, reminding him of the Russian promise of privilege forever. But to their disadvantage, the delegates could not speak Russian. They failed to have an audience with the Tsar, but his officials would not promise continued military exemption. Drawing on their Prussian experience, a Mennonite delegate suggested that the Mennonites might pay money for exemption. With no promises forthcoming, the delegates returned home with a sense of foreboding. The next year, they sent another delegation, but yet again, they had no audience with the Tsar. And again, the delegation returned home with disappointment, but the sense of foreboding increased. The next year, in 1873, several more delegations went to Petersburg for the same purpose, but to no avail. But in 1874, the law provided non-combatant forestry service for Mennonites during peacetime and hospital service during wartime. While all the delegations were taking place, the Mennonites began to think about emigration. Where should they go? New Zealand? Australia? North or South America? But nobody seemed to know much about any of those places. Leonard Suderman, who favored emigration to North America, described the common impression his Mennonite people had of North America. Quote, "To many, America meant a country interesting to the adventurer, an asylum for convicts. How could one live in peace under his vine and fig tree amid such people? Such a life might be possible for those who had their pockets full of revolvers, but for a non-resistant people, it would be impossible to found homes amid such surroundings." End of quote. Take a look at what's on the overhead here. They did eventually think about America, and I'll tell you that story shortly. And the reason, immediate reason was, they were losing their guaranteed government privileges. They were needing to serve in the military. They needed to learn Russian and become Russianized. And they were losing their freedom. And so, they needed to do something. And what they did actually turned into their faith preservation. What they were forced to do. And they developed a strong sense of peoplehood by what they did. And they also ended up with material wealth because of what they did. Now, I'd like to show you some pictures here. This is a Mennonite home in the Vistula area, Delta of Poland. I want you to take a look at that house. This is a continuation of the way the Dutch people have built their houses. If you go to Holland today, you will see house barns. It's all one building. The back part is where the animals are and where the barn is, and then there's a solid border wall, and then the people live in the next part. And you can look at the roofs, and you can see how big the living space is and how big the barn is. The barn is still thatch in many of these farms. Today, the thatch is about 6 inches thick. I don't know how long it's been on there, but where the people live is not thatch, it's metal roof. And we had a chance to go into some of those, and it's just, into those barns, it's just really interesting. You look on the underside of the roof, you see thatch up there. You look on the outside, you see thatch. And by the way, when the Nazis rolled into Holland during World War II, they had their flamethrowers. And everything that they could burn with their flamethrowers, you can imagine what thatch did. Those farms all disappeared. All the barns that are still there were not caught by a flamethrower. The Nazis missed those. And they are still there to this day. That's really, really different from the way we think about living. But the Paul Yoder family, this is just normal for them. Is that right? You've seen many of these. Okay, they took that idea and way of building houses and barns to the Vistula area in Poland. And this is one of those. See, here's the house, and back here's the barn, all attached. And I don't think there's barn smell in the house. There's enough division that people live in a normal house just like you do, and their animals live in a barn like your animals do, and it's just an easy way to get to the barn. And you never even have to go out into the cold to get to the barn. You just open the door and you're in the barn. Okay, well, this idea had worked so well in Holland, they took it to the Vistula area in Prussia, and then they took it to Russia as well. But they didn't stop in Russia. There is a picture of, this one's in southern Manitoba. You see the house? You see the barn? It's all connected. It says that house is still in use in southern Manitoba. Sometime when you're in Manitoba, driving through, make some friends and say, I'd like to see how this looks, how this works. Okay, I told you before that windmills are like the icon of these people. This is what they used in Holland to pump water out of the polder land that they were trying to create. This is what they took to the Vistula Delta area to pump water. This is what they took to Russia. And this is what they took to Manitoba. Same thing. It's a part of who they are. Also, as I was mentioning, I think Tuesday night, the way they lived in Russia, this is actually a layout of a village in Russia. That's Eichenfeld. This is in 1919. This is after the story of what we have for tonight. But you notice, there's one street. And in this place, the Froese blacksmith shop. Here's where Peter Quaring lived. Here's Heinrich's place. Here's Jacob Dombrowski. And a Friesen. Here's David Volk. Here's Wilhelm Martin Harder. Here's where Berg lives, and John Peters, and Isaac John Warkenton, and so on. Now, their farms were out behind. And if they didn't have land, enough land here, they went someplace else to a distance. But this is the village system. This is the way they wanted to live. And the old colonists wanted to maintain this in southern Manitoba. The Bergthalers were not so insistent on this. The old colony just insisted on this. And so this picture is actually taken from Manitoba. And so that's Rheinfeld, Manitoba. That's what it looks like probably today yet, or close to it today. One street, everybody lives on the same street. That's a village, and the farmlands are out around. Oh, by the way, when some of these people came to Kansas, they started out this way, but it didn't last. This was not maintained in Kansas. This was maintained for a while in Manitoba. This is, I showed you this one before. These are some of the main areas of settlement who operated with villages like this. For example, in Cortiza, there might have been, I don't know, 35 villages, but those 35 villages were interspersed with Lutheran villages and Catholic villages. The same over here. They lived and mixed in. They were a closed unit by village, but they were mixed in with other kinds of people as well. Okay, I want you to pay particular notice to this place down here. I'm going to talk to you shortly about this. And also want you to take notice to this place right here, Berdyansk. Okay, Berdyansk is a port town. And this became the place where these colonies could ship their grain for loading onto ship to be exported to wherever. Okay, if you got a copy of the Anabaptist Voice and you read about Cornelius Jansen, he moved from Prussia over here to Russia to be a grain broker. And this is where he lived, in Berdyansk. And if you read the story in the Anabaptist Voice, there's quite a long story. I cannot tell you that story tonight. You'll just have to read about it. I think there's two copies over there. If you didn't get one last night, there's first come, first serve out there. Yes. Yes. That's right. And so these were pockets and islands of German people. And that's what the Russian government was concerned about. We want to get rid of these German people. We want to turn this into a land of Russia. Get rid of the German stuff, including Mennonites, Lutheran, and Catholics, wherever. Okay, here is my friend Cornelius Jansen. I would really like to meet that man. I didn't know about him until about a year ago. This man is really, in my mind, a hero. This man gave his life for his people. And he's the one who got kicked out of Russia. Whenever the police came to him, they said, "You got 10 days to leave." And he begged off and got 2 months' notice and was exiled from Russia, never to return. And that's his wife beside him, and this is his wife's sister. She had Kleine-Gemeinde connections. He did not. If you go to, he actually settled in Beatrice, Nebraska. Edward Millers was telling me last night about some of that area. And they had a son, Peter Jansen, and the name, the town of Jansen, Nebraska, is named after their son, Peter. Very, very interesting man. He was a prosperous Prussian Mennonite grain merchant. He also served as the Prussian consul at Berdyansk, a harbor town on the Sea of Azov. Mennonite grain and other produce was exported to the world from Berdyansk. Because Jansen lived and worked at this export city, he had an eye for what was happening in the larger world. Also, because he understood that the Mennonites needed to emigrate from Russia, he wrote letters to men in North America about whom he had heard, one of them being John F. Funk of Elkhart, Indiana. I'm going to pause here. Some people, whenever they hear of things, just simply sit still and wait to see what happens. Other people understand the significance of what's happening and begin to do something about it. Well, that's this man right here. He did not wait around. And by the providence of God, he made a major contribution by not sitting on his hands. And here is the man he had heard about in America, John F. Funk, down at Elkhart, Indiana. Okay? We'll just leave that one. And I'll put Cornelius back up here again. When he's writing to John F. Funk, here's the kind of thing he was asking about. He wanted to know about the United States military laws, natural resources, land laws, especially of the western states, and other questions prospective settlers might have. When he got answers, he didn't keep them to himself. He printed them and distributed the correspondence among the Russian Mennonites. At the same time, he communicated with the British consul at Berdyansk about military exemption in Canada and about the availability of large tracts of land that might be suitable places for compact settlements. When the Canadian authorities discovered that 50,000 industrious farmers might be interested in Canada, Canadian authorities took steps to direct the probable immigration to Canada. Canada needed farmers to take up empty western lands, lest the United States take advantage of the situation. They even sent a special commissioner, William Hespeller, to South Russia to create an interest in Canada. This is what I meant the other night by saying, Canada and the United States are bidding on these people. They both want them. In 1872, the British consul in Berdyansk wrote to the Foreign Affairs Office in London, this is the British consul, recommending the Mennonites for Canada. Quote, 7 years' residence in this country has enabled me to acquire a good knowledge of them, and I am personally acquainted with many of the elders. I feel no hesitation, therefore, in saying that these Germans would prove a valuable acquisition to any country they may select for their home. If they find difficulty in proceeding to Canada, they will seek refuge in the United States, to which country their attention has already been directed. But as I have already stated, their first choice falls on British soil, and though their determination to leave this country is fixed, yet from what I can learn, they will do so with regret if they have to leave for any other country than Canada. So, the Canadian government offered William Hespeller $2 for each Mennonite he directed to Canada. Hespeller wrote back about the offer, quote, it would not create a very favorable effect. Neither would the agency be accepted by any of the Mennonites, as, according to my experience of them, I find them more conscientious than their confessionalists in Canada or the United States. It would look, in their eyes, too much like dealing in human beings. They are not a people like the general run of immigrants. They are a reasoning, thinking, cautious, and to a large extent, an educated people. Now, pause. I'm not quite sure what he means when he says that the Russians who want to come are more conscientious than the Mennonites already in America. I've read a little bit. Whenever these people got to Ontario, they stayed in a Mennonite home up there, and they weren't all that impressed with it. I said at the end of our day today in the roundtable class that our people have demonstrated some weakness, especially in the 1800s, and I think that's what they saw. Things were not quite what they should have been. But Canada really wanted these people. The Canadian government authorized Hespeller to grant the Mennonites all their demands: exemption from military service, free land, 160 acres, to each head of a family as part of a large compact land unit, freedom of religion, the right to maintain the German language, control their own schools, basically a repeat of Catherine the Great's offer of 100 years before. But when the Russian government discovered what was going on beneath their noses, Hespeller, get out now. Cornelius Jansen, get out now. But Jansen had already done his homework. He had discovered that the American government was not really interested in the proposed migration, but the railroad companies were most interested. They needed buyers for their railroad land, the Santa Fe Company in particular. Now, let me pause here. There's something I'm not going to tell you here, but it's in that Anabaptist voice. This man and his son went to visit President Grant. And they asked President Grant, can you guarantee us all these things? And President Grant said, this is a democracy. I can't promise you anything. They were used to being subjects of a king or a ruler, a czar, who could do that, but the American president couldn't do that. But they were so impressed that President Grant told them that he still knew how to hitch up horses and run a team. In their minds, government officials are way up here. You have servants to do that kind of stuff. And this was so impressive to these people, especially his son. They also had some other things to say. You can read the rest in the Anabaptist voice. So, in 1875, the Santa Fe Company sent this man, Carl B. Schmidt, C.B. Schmidt. In 1875, the Santa Fe Company sent this man to South Russia to bring as many Mennonites as possible to their railroad lands in Kansas. The Santa Fe instructed Schmidt, quote, you bring those Mennonites at any cost. By 1874, emigration was the buzz talk of South Russia. Hespeller had suggested that the Mennonites send delegates to make a special tour of both Canada and the United States. The year before, in 1873, the Mennonites sent 12 men, Jacob Buller of the Alexander Wool Congregation, Leonard Suderman of Berdyansk, representing the Malachna Colony, Tobias Unruh from the Bohemian settlements, Andreas Schrag, representing the Swiss settlements of the same area, Heinrich Wiebe and Oberscholtz, Jacob Peters from the Bergthal Colony, along with Cornelius Burr, who traveled at his own expense, Wilhelm Ewert from the West Prussian Mennonites. Get that. Back in West Prussia, there was interest also. Cornelius Taves and David Clausen from the Kleine Gemeinde, and brothers Paul and Lorenz Schetter from the Hutterites. And by the way, I'll pause to say, Paul and Lorenz Schetter also had a personal visit with President Grant. These 12 men spent the summer of 1873 investigating the frontier lands of North America from Manitoba in the north, south through Minnesota, Dakota, Nebraska, and Kansas. They checked soil, climate, satisfactory available land, political conditions, and military regulations. I jumped ahead of myself. The Schetter brothers, the Hutterite brothers, even had an audience with President Grant, who on his own could not promise them military exemption, but did tell them that forced military service for conscientious objectors was unlikely. Now let's pause to take a look at these lands. I think I showed you this the other night. Okay, the Canadian lands we're talking about are here. This is the Western Reserve and this is the Eastern Reserve. And I think they only ended up with 25 families. This man from Minnesota really wanted these people, but that's all he got. And this is where the Hutterites came, all of them, the same place. And down here in Beatrice, right here, is where Cornelius Jansen ended up with a few other people. There were some Kleine Gemeinde people also settled in the same area. His wife had Kleine Gemeinde connections. But down here is where most of them came, into your backyard. Here's a close-up of southern Manitoba. You'll notice that the West Reserve is right on the U.S. border. This river, the Red River, divides North Dakota from Minnesota. Okay? And so on the other side of the river, the east side of the river, is the East Reserve. The old colony, what we call Old Colony Mennonites, didn't settle over here. This is where the Kleinigemeinde settled and the Bergthalers. The old colony people came over here. This was actually a better place than what this was. How many of you people, this is Lake Winnipeg, and here is the city of Winnipeg. How many of you have been to Winnipeg or this area of southern Manitoba? I'm going to see your hands. Well, bless your hearts, I have not gotten there yet. So I would love to go to a place like this, like that, to see what it's like today. Okay, I'll just hold this a little bit. When the Russian government discovered the likelihood of losing between 40 and 50,000 industrious Mennonites, they were ready to make concessions. The Russian government sent General von Todleben, himself a German Lutheran, to meet with the Mennonites. He said, quote, "His Majesty, Tsar Alexander, has sent me to you, and I am to tell you he loves you. You are worthy to dwell in his empire. Why do you have in mind to emigrate? 100 years your fathers have been in this land. You enjoy it here. You have fine schools, fine churches, fine houses and gardens. You need not work for yourselves. The work is done without you. All you have to do is look after the work. You can hire Russian laborers at low wages. Why do you emigrate?" Excuse me. "When you come to America, you will have to dig trees, weed the roots, and break the prairie, and do all the work yourself. Here, you have it as fine as you wish." End of quote. He told them that as Russian citizens, no longer subjects of the Tsar, they could do alternate service work in the national interest by doing forestry work. He informed that in the recent American Civil War, the non-resistant people in the Confederacy had not been exempted. I find it interesting that Russia was watching what was going on in the United States, and they knew their story over there and could talk intelligently to these people. General von Todleben made his point. The more liberal-minded of the Mennonites decided to reconsider. 2/3 of the total number. Why leave when concessions were forthcoming? The concessions applied to both peacetime and wartime. Interestingly, the concession only applied to the original Mennonite settlers and their descendants. The concessions did not apply to any new immigrants to the colonies. Cortizza and Halbstadt leaders wrote a letter of thanks to the general and expressed their satisfaction with the concessions. They did remind him that they needed to be in complete control of their school system. A strong minority, the more conservative-minded, was not convinced. Some had already disposed of their properties. Entire villages continued their preparation for emigration. These would not compromise their consciences. 2 Cortizza daughter colonies, Bergthal and Furstenland, decided to emigrate along with almost the entire congregation at Alexanderwall, the Swiss of Volhynia, the Hutterites, and the Kleinigemeinde. These were the large bodies to emigrate. Here's Bergthal. That's the first daughter colony of Cortizza. Here's Furstenland. I'm not exactly sure where Alexanderwall is on there. But Kleinigemeinde was a revival group that came out of Molochna. And here, of course, is where the Hutterites are from. Okay, now that's just the large bodies. But from every settlement and from almost every village, individual families joined the emigration movement. In addition, many families in the German Lutheran and German Catholic neighboring colonies also decided to emigrate. On top of these numbers, some Russian Mennonites saw economic opportunity beckoning in America and emigrated for economic reasons. Now, some Mennonites felt that moving further east to Turkestan was the answer. So here's the colonies again. And their traditional way of handling pressure was to move east. And so some people, how many of you read the story, The Long Trek, which is the story of Klaus Epp? One of you. Okay. That's a fascinating story. This man thought that he had strange ideas. It was premillennialism going way astray. And it's a long, tragic story. But they went east. They actually did. And it was an awful story. And actually, these people ran into Muslims and actually got along with the Muslims, although they suffered an awful lot at the hands of the natives. And eventually, partway through, some of these people just ended up giving up and coming to the United States. It's amazing any of them survived. But I have a book at home. It's called I'm drawing a blank now. Something about it's the story of a boy who was only 14 when his parents left and came down here. Journey of Faith in a Hostile World is the title. And it has some incredible things in it. And I'm not even going to start that. While most were preparing to emigrate west, some prepared to emigrate east. And you can read this in The Great Trek as well as A Journey of Faith in a Hostile World. When it was all said and done, 18,000 Mennonites emigrated from Russia from 1874 to 1880. 8,000 emigrated to Canada and 10,000 to the United States, mostly to Kansas. Most of those who emigrated to the United States became part of the General Conference, now MCUSA. Now, this particular map shows several emigrations, but you'll notice that there's 18,000 of them coming in this time period, which is in the 1870s. Later on, after the Bolsheviks came over, took over, and there was great suffering in the land, there's a whole bunch more that came over. And also, you're going to notice that some of these people ended up going to Mexico, and later on in 1929, 1930, these are the last people to get out before Stalin put down the door and said, "That's it." And they went to Brazil and to Paraguay. Okay, well, what we're talking about now is just this first group of people coming across, these 18,000. Now, let me tell you a part of the story of one of the very first groups to emigrate to the United States. Okay, on this map here, these people that I'm going to read about next came from this area down here in the Crimean Peninsula. This was called the Krimer Group. It was composed of 35 families from the Crimean Peninsula who arrived as a church body in New York on July 15, 1874. Jacob Wiebe, acquainted with John F. Funk through his German paper, led his people to the Elkhart train depot early on Sunday morning, July 20. Here is Elder Wiebe. Evidently, John Funk didn't know they were coming or when they were going to get there, because it says that they got there Sunday morning, July 20. The previous night, Funk's daughter, Grace Ann, had died. The exhausted Funk was roused from a short sleep and was told that a large group of Russian Mennonites had shown up at the train depot with their baggage and were awaiting further direction. Funk wrote, quote, "Under the circumstances, it was indeed a question as to what I could do for them. But near the church was a vacant house, quite roomy. I secured the key and opened it. After hauling the heavy baggage and the old people into the house, I called a grocer in the vicinity and asked him to open his store and sell these people bread, meat, coffee, and tea, etc. They took the work into their own hands and washed, dressed, made dinner, and at 2 o'clock had church services. At 2 o'clock p.m., at the 2 o'clock p.m. service, Wiebe preached to both the immigrants and the Elkhart. He preached to the immigrants and to the Elkhart people. Both groups were deeply stirred and moved to tears. Well, this Krimmer group stayed in Elkhart for a month, staying temporarily in a rented house, as well as in the Prairie Street Church House, and later in an empty factory building. One of their number died and was buried at Elkhart. And you have to read the rest of the story in the book, They Seek a Country. And I won't read that now. Okay, now out here in Kansas, I'm not sure if this is about the same group of people. This might be just a group of Russian Mennonites. The Topeka Commonwealth newspaper described the arriving strangers in the September 10, 1874 issue. Quote, "Large crowds of visitors flocked to the King's Bridge shops yesterday to see the 600 Mennonites who arrived there Thursday. They were dressed in their primitive homespun garments, which were usually of coarse wool and of the most primitive style. The women and children were all consuming huge pieces of bread. They had funny old handkerchiefs tied around their heads. They had all brought huge tin pans, crockery, etc. with them, and baskets groaning under loads of bread, cheese, and sausage. The men appeared to have conscientious scruples against wearing clothes that fit them. The men..." "The men's vests therefore descend towards the knee, and their pants possess an alarming amount of slack." "Their favorite headgear is a flat cloth cap, which they pull off in saluting any person. This habit they will soon drop now that they have arrived in Kansas, where," quote, "nobody respects nothing." Okay, so this is European. As soon as you meet somebody, you take your cap off. Well, in Kansas, you just didn't do that. By the close of 1879, nearly 15,000 Mennonites had purchased land from the Santa Fe, a large part of the 1 million acres of the railroad grant land from the United States government. And here's how this worked. Okay, that dotted line you see is the railroad. The United States government said, "You folks in the railroads, we will give you land if you do it this way." You notice that these are square miles, and there's 10 miles this way and 10 miles this way, which is railroad right of way. And these are alternating squares. The white squares will say, "The sale of this land goes to the U.S. government, and the sale of the shaded lands goes to the railroads." So this was an inducement to fill up the land with settlers. Now, the railroads stood to gain from this, because if you have farms close by the railroads, you're going to use the railroad as your shipping. And so it worked really, really well. Now, get this. They came in 1874. Within 5 years, the 15,000 Mennonites had purchased land from the Santa Fe, a large part of the 1 million acres of this railroad grant land. 10 years later, the Santa Fe railroad grant land was gone. The land was growing the new turkey red winter wheat brought from Russia. Now let's look a little more at this. Now, when some of these people came in, you notice that they're keeping their ideas from Russia. Here is a section. That's 1 square mile. See, they put a village street down the center. And you have to have a church in there. And that's a blacksmith shop. And I don't know, I guess that says store. And over here is a school. And over here is another school. And this is the South Cottonwood Creek. Is that anywhere around here? Do you recognize Cottonwood Creek? Is it northeast of here? Okay, so that's close by. Well, there is the Santa Fe Railroad. And you notice all those towns that developed along Santa Fe, including Hutchinson. Where is it? Right there. That's Hutchinson, right on the Santa Fe. There's a railroad right out here, right? This is a part of this whole scheme. Yes. Okay, yeah, I got to tell you this. Read that one. In 1874, simultaneously with the grasshopper, the Mennonites began to invade Kansas. The grasshopper came from the northwest, the Mennonites from the east, far from beyond the Atlantic. Their respective missions were diametrically opposed to each other. The grasshopper came to destroy, the Mennonites came to create and build up. The grasshoppers accomplished their mission in short order and left Kansas never to return. The Mennonites remained and multiplied and made Kansas the banner wheat state of the Union, just as they had made southern Russia the chief supply source of wheat for European consumption. Written by C.B. Schmidt, that agent. Okay.
You sir? I forgot what it was.
Okay. It's the... It's a book that I have at home.
Okay.
I'll have to think about that, Gary. Well, what they did in Kansas, they also did in Nebraska. There's the Union Pacific. And the lands filled up wherever the railroads ran. Every other section of land in green, which is 4.85 million acres, that's the Union Pacific. And you can't see the difference in color here. But the Burlington and Missouri, every other section of brown, 2.5 million acres. Additional state and federal grants to other railroad companies totaled around 820,000 acres. Now, some human interest things. When our friends got here, this is what it looked like. This is the street that they plowed. This is Gnadenhau. Is that close by here? Do you recognize that? Okay. But you notice that their first houses were really primitive. But in 1 year, this is what it looked like. These people are rather industrious. I wonder what it looked like 5 years after that. Here is a typical family. This is in German. I can't read it. But it looks like the family of Johann Friesen. I don't know which group he's from. If anybody can read German and can interpret that for me, I'd be glad. And I don't know, do you folks know where that stands? Okay. It says, Turkey red wheat. Children in Russia handpicked the first seeds of this famous winter wheat for Kansas. They belonged to the Mennonite colonies preparing to emigrate from the steppes to the American prairies. The peace-loving sect originally from Holland, the Mennonites had gone to the Crimea from Prussia in 1890 when Catherine the Great offered free lands, military exemption, and religious freedom. They prospered until these privileges were threatened in 1871. 3 years later, they emigrated to Kansas, where the Santa Fe Railroad offered thousands of acres on good terms in McPherson, Harvey, Marion, and Reno counties, and where the legislature passed a bill which exempted religious objectors from military service. Within a month after landing in New York, the Mennonites planted the red gold grains their children had selected. The harvest was the first of the great crops of hard turkey red wheat and its derivatives that have made Kansas the granary of the nation. And I don't think the United States ever regretted that they got Mennonites. And I think that Canada wished they would have gotten a few more, but that's the way it was. Okay, any questions before I close? We're just going to stop there for today. Okay? Thank you for your attention.